So thank you all for joining. The talk is going to be around, I'll try not to make it long, around 35 to 40 minutes. And I'll go quickly through some of the concepts that I'm going to be discussing. But first off, again, thank you for joining. This might seem like a weird topic, perhaps. Some people might consider it not so serious, maybe, because what the hell are we talking about when we're talking about football and philosophy, right? And or why would we even consider football, which is only an entertainment game where 22 players are running behind the ball and they're trying to score games and to score goals, and then you have fans cheating for absolutely nothing. And it's like it doesn't take any effort. Maybe if a player can train, etc., they can score goals. You know, it's doesn't take much effort to play football, and we all do that in the parking lot, or we all did that as kids, and now we play football with our friends, etc. So, why does it really warrant a philosophical reflection? And I'm not here to justify whether it is important to do a philosophical reflection about football. It's just I'm going to be trying to tackle the concept of beauty in football, because it is really nicknamed the beautiful game. So why this doesn't mean that other games are not beautiful, of course, but then given that football is a sensation across the globe and absolutely almost anyone with a ball would play a kicking game, then in so far as it is a sensation, why do we consider football beautiful? Why is it a beautiful sport as compared to maybe other sports that might be less beautiful or that might not be as beautiful? So from this perspective, I'm going to be trying to approach the aesthetics of football. Aesthetics is a field of philosophy whereby we discuss beauty and other concepts and other aesthetic categories. So before we start, today's outline is going to be as follows. I'm going to first off give you a very brief definition of two aesthetic categories, namely the beautiful and the sublime. Then I'm going to be discussing or recounting a Mayan myth that appears in the Popol Vuh, which is a text that collects or documents myths of the Mayans. And then I'm going to be doing a sort of reflection on the history of football, its origin and evolution, a very quick one, of course. And then I'm going to be focusing on the offside rule and why I think the offside rule is essential in us understanding the beautiful game. Like, for me, offside, the offside rule makes it possible for us to really enjoy the game. It creates this tension whereby players are trying to look for space. So the offside rule is going to be, for me, I'm going to be arguing a precondition for the generation of the tension on the football field. This tension creates or allows the players to constantly look for spaces. And this emergence of space, metaphorically speaking, is what I will argue causes an aesthetic experience. This is why we all, or at least football fans, enjoy the game. And this is why we constantly come back to the game, because there's something new, even though the game is just has clear set of rules. So this is just a brief outline. Football, as I said, is known as a beautiful game across the globe, so much so that in Los Angeles County Museum, they had a gallery or an exhibition that was tackling the issue of the beautiful game. This is one example of football usually, or when I say, or when people say the beautiful game, they mean football. Not only that, it's a sensational game such that during the World Cup, you had 3.5 billion people watch the Russia World Cup and 1.12 billion people watch the France and Croatia. Now, of course, there's marketing there. There's a lot of things going on and there's a lot of money and so much is at stake, but still people are interested in the game. So it's not something that to be taken lightly. It is one form of entertainment, yes, but then there's something more to it that makes people enjoy it. And that's what I'm going to be trying to tackle today. Not only that, but even match commentaries usually are peppered with adjectives like a beautiful pass, a sublime goal. And when players are playing are being tough and injuring other players, or if for those who know players like Pepe, usually they are frowned upon. Like, dude, try not to tackle harshly, try not to injure the player, etc. And they usually nowadays referees try to protect players like Messi, like Ronaldo, because they offer some sort of good games. Maradona was fucked by Goycochea because of a harsh tackle. And ever since then, his career kind of was heavily affected, right? So there's always this reference to a beautiful game, aesthetically pleasing, etc. Roy Hodgson, for example, if you can, I'll play that. Just a sec.
An alien play this game of ours, the likes of which we've never seen before. And I've had the privilege to call so many of his wonder goals, and he staggers you with the virtuosity of the range of skills that he has.
Options. Messi gets it back. Messi!
Well, football and genius.
Goosebumps, yeah, right? So it really, there's something about it that captivates people. And there really is something about football that we cannot maybe explain. Why would a person have such a reaction looking at a random player score a goal? And so this is what I'm going to be trying to explore today. But first, I'm going to be discussing a bit briefly what aesthetics is, because the entire subject here is the beauty of football, right? So how can we define beauty? This is what the field of aesthetics and philosophy normally tackles. So for example, in aesthetics, we attempt to answer questions like what makes a certain object beautiful? Can we say that beauty is subjective or objective? If it is objective, can we come up with a certain set of criteria and that would allow us to identify that this object is beautiful or not? Is beauty to be found in the object, or is it just a matter of perception, of our perception? Is it universal or is it relative? So these are kind of the questions that aesthetics normally attempts to answer. Some aesthetic categories include the beauty and the sublime. Beauty is normally, because this is not a philosophy course or anything of the sort, I'm going to be referring to them trying to define them in a very simple way without complicating things. Just a disclaimer on the side, the subjects of beauty and sublime have occupied many philosophers across ages and across different periods. And a lot of books and essays have been written on these subjects. So what I'm going to be doing is going to be considered a heresy within academic fields, but I don't care. I just want to get you guys to have an idea what beauty and sublime can mean, because they sometimes have different definitions, different ways of tackling the issue, etc. So first, the beautiful is anything that has the combination of whose qualities evoke in us some sort of pleasure. some sort of pleasing sensations, right? It's usually nice to the eye. So if we look at this garden, maybe it's the combination of colors, the combination of forms, the shapes that we can probably see there allow us to enjoy the scenery. So it's maybe relaxing, it evokes or it inspires in us sensations that are really pleasing. So this is what we call beautiful. Whereas when it comes to the sublime is the feeling that arises in us such that we experience or we are overwhelmed by emotions like terror and awe. So a sublime is any event that is awe-inspiring, that whereby we are overwhelmed by emotions of, on the one hand, fear, but on the other hand, appreciation at the same time. I'll try to read this from Burke. I'm not going to be reading the entire thing. The passion caused by the great and sublime in nature, when those causes operate most powerfully, is astonishment. And astonishment is the state of the soul in which all its motions are suspended with some degree of horror. So, for example, unlike the beauty, which is actually pleasant to the eye, the sublime is like standing at the edge of the cliff and you're realizing how the grandiosity and the grandeur of nature and the fact that you might die, but then at the same time, you're relieved that you're really not going to be dying because, you know, you're a bit safe. So if you're looking at a volcano eruption or at a volcano erupting and you're looking at it on TV, on the one hand, you experience these feelings of awe whereby and fear because you could die if you were there, but at the same time, you're relieved that you're really actually not there. So it combines these two sentiments, two emotions it's awe-inspiring on the one hand, and at the same time, you are relieved. So astonishment, as I have said, is the effect of the sublime in its highest degree. The inferior effects are admiration, reverence, and respect. And this is key for me to tie it back to football towards the end of this discussion. So think in terms of beauty, pleasing, sublime, terrifying, but at the same time, it's awe-inspiring. Now, what I'm going to be doing, like my two claims are as follows. An aesthetic experience is when you are moved by a certain object. So I say, for example, that this scenery is beautiful, or this goal is beautiful, or this play is beautiful. So when I'm experiencing this is what we call aesthetic experience. The claims that I'm football is aesthetically pleasing. The claims here are insofar as the aesthetic experience is a complex one, and insofar as the aesthetic experience must be made possible by the distinctive characteristics of the sport itself. So why is football beautiful? Well, because it allows us to have these aesthetic experiences due to the distinctive characteristics of the game itself. So within the rules of football, within the way the game is played and the formations and how players are trying to score a goal, etc., the different tactics and strategies, these strategies and these tactics as they unfold on the pitch allow us to have an aesthetic experience. This will become, this is mainly my claim and I'm going to be supporting this. But before this, what is football, right? How did football come to be? Because there are records across ages and across different cultures where people played a ball game. We see that in Egypt, ancient Egypt. We see that in the Roman Empire. We see that in South Mesoamerica, the Americas in general. So much so that in the Popol Vuh, there's a myth about a hero twins who were playing. It's a long story. I'm going to be narrowing it down briefly. If you're interested to read about it, check it out. The Hero Twins, Hunapu and Shbalanke, if I, it's, I definitely pronounced it, mispronounced it, but, or you get the point. So these two Hero Twins were playing a ball game, and the lords of the underworld were annoyed by all the noise. Like, think in terms of if you have neighbors in the building and they're playing, the kids are playing football and you're annoyed, you want to sleep, and then you're like, oh, come on, you guys, we just want to relax a bit. So the lords of the underworld invite them over for a ball game. They have to pass a certain tests, etc., etc., and then they get killed, they come back, they trick the gods, and stuff happens. But the idea here is that, so even in Mayan mythology, you have a ball game. And I don't know if you are aware of this inspired a game, a Mayan game, whereby the loser would have his cut, the team would have their heads cut off, inspired by this myth. So it was very violent, right? But can we say that this ball game is the same as modern football? And what differentiates football? Like, why is particularly football considered a sport in this case versus all the ball games that have been played across cultures? Because many tried to argue that football has its roots in this or that culture, but then there's something different. Because the reason why we cannot consider them sports as such, it's because one, it had different functions, religious, mythological, societal, etc. It wasn't a game, it wasn't a kicking game proper. It wasn't a game that was regulated as we have our, as football is regulated now. It was just a mere play. There were no strategies, there were no tactics. It wasn't as complex as football is now. But of course, football was not created out of nothing, right? So it has its roots in all these, not in one culture in particular, but then it's people for ages played a ball game. But then what happened in England was something different. Bit by bit, all these characteristics and features of the ball game came together and were codified. Yeah. So now football achieved, or at the during the 18th and, well, 19th century, particularly, the game became, or football became, a proper game. It grew out of the religiosity. It became more secular. It acquired more cultural importance. It started having tactics and rules in general, and it became associated with some sort of spectacle, a spectacle that takes place at a stadium. And this stadium becomes, you know, in a way, people would go there for the spectacle and for the show. And, you know, it's, you want to be at the stadium, kind of, if you could. So you would look at the architecture of the stadium and the surroundings and stuff like that. So how would we define the emergence of football? From, it was, in the beginning, was chaos, as Wilson would argue. And from chaos, and football was without form, and then the Victorians came and codified it. And after then, theorists analyzed it. So first, we had chaos. People were just playing football because they wanted to pass the time. There was no intrinsic goal. It was like, you know, you just have, when you're with your, when you're kids, like you just, you're playing, right? You're kicking the ball, you're passing the time. It's a movement in free space. There really is no pitch with any kind of designated goals or proper measurements, etc. And time has no important role. So it's, there is no, the game is not basically measured by any time or any clock or anything of the sort. It's just you have a ball with some friends, you kick it around, you enjoy it. But then it became more organized. For example, it started becoming governed by a set of unified rules. Before that, it wasn't. And different countries like Scotland and England had different offside rules. And then they all unified them. And people started having more technical awareness. And it had a clear goal. So the football, the goal of the game is to score actually goals, right? But the question becomes, what is really the ultimate goal of football, right? Are we going to be looking at football from a utilitarian perspective, saying, you know what, and so far as we score a goal, 1-0 is great, you know, don't concede goals, score one goal and you should be great. Is this a way of approaching, like, is this a good way of approaching football? Well, some people, some coaches, some clubs, some schools of thought approach the game as such. They would think, you know what, I don't care about putting in a good show. I don't care about putting in a good spectacle. I don't really care about whether my fans and the spectators enjoy the show insofar as I score a goal and I win. So this is more of a utilitarian kind of approach whereby I just want to score a goal and that's it. But others want something more from the game. They put into it, or they argue that the game has to be a spectacle that people would enjoy and not die of boredom, right? And this is what I'm going to be supporting myself. So for me, just like this Danny Blanchflower's quote, the great fallacy is that the game is first and foremost about winning. It's nothing of the kind. The game is about glory. It's about doing things in style, with flourish, about going out and beating the other lot, not waiting for them to die of boredom, right? So this is why I think I personally support this approach to football. It's like, if you're going to be parking the bus, if you're going to be only defending, not conceding goals, and then scoring a goal by a counterattack or from a free kick or a corner kick or something along the lines, it loses its charm, kind of. You might disagree with that, but at least my perspective of football is that I'm more of a beautiful game kind of fan. So, but why is it considered the beautiful game? Is it because we easily understand its rules? Like everyone here, at least, knows a thing or two about football. It's like, it's not really complicated, no? Well, let's look at the components of the game. So what constitutes the entire football game? One, we can look at the parts depending on each other to form a collective whole, right? Because is football only about two people or two teams playing? Well, no, because the teams also have the clubs have history, they have fan bases, they have stadiums, and they have histories, and these stadiums have been there for hundreds of years. Well, 100 years in the case of, if we're talking Camp Nou, Barcelona, or English teams, etc., or Atletico Madrid, who recently changed their stadiums. And then all this history transforms into also interesting clashes between teams of the same city, which are called derbies or clasicos, which, like, for example, Barcelona against Real Madrid. So this becomes a classic, kind of a match that everyone wants to watch. So if we're going to be looking at football, we cannot just isolate the game proper, because there is more to it than just that. Think now in terms of COVID, right? Corona. It lost something, the games, because we're watching them without fans in the stadiums. And you watch it, and now they try to replicate, for example, the cheering of the crowds. They have it. It reminded me of the sitcoms. They tell you when to laugh and when to cry, kind of, and stuff like that. But it really isn't as interesting, right? When you have people in the stadium, and even if you're at home watching it, it transmits something to you. You enjoy it more. You get involved in the game more. Even the players, because the crowds can pressure the players. If you're playing, let's say, think in terms of Barcelona and Liverpool, right? Barcelona went to Liverpool, they were winning, and then they lost 4-0, and they were knocked out of the Champions League. So being there in the stadium with the crowd cheering and chanting and supporting their team, it adds something. It becomes a different kind of spectacle. So the players themselves can be divided into we have players and then the spectators, who can be divided into people who are engaged and people who are neutral, right? So if, for example, if I'm watching a Barcelona versus Real Madrid, I would be supporting, of course, Barcelona. But then if I'm watching Getafe against, Valladolid, for example, I don't care. So I'm neutral. So I would watch the game maybe, because I want to enjoy some football, but then I really don't care. Not unless the result of the game is going to be affecting the ranking and the table of the teams, etc. Right? So, and engaged for or against. Like if Real Madrid is playing against Atletico Madrid, I would, just like this picture, which I took, it's like anti-Madridista, to the bone. Like against any team Real Madrid is playing, I want them to lose. So I'm involved and I actually want them to lose. So you have players, clubs, histories, etc., clashes, things that build up, people who are involved, etc. But looking at the game itself now, what makes it so engaging? Like, why do we care about all this? It's not only about the winning. It's not only about the goals. It's about the rivalry. It's about it's about the history of the clubs and whom you support, etc. So it becomes a bit more complex. And what makes it so is the way I think football has been or has evolved, the rules of the game. Because it wasn't always the case, right? They constantly, the football associations and FIFA, and they look at the game and the rules, and they constantly are changing, right? I don't know if you're aware of this, but the offside rule was not always the current offside rule that we have. And because of the offside rule, which I'm going to be explaining shortly, I argue objectively, a play is beautiful insofar as there's an emergence of the radically new. So the offside rule creates a tension that results in an interesting dialectic between the teams. Both teams are trying to escape the offside, are trying to create sets whereby they don't have an offside so that they can actually score a legal goal. Because of that, what they are trying to do is constantly look for spaces, whether it's a set kick, whether it's a corner. Well, corner, it's different. But if it's ricocheting, whether it's a passing ball, whether you're trying to pass to your friend, etc. Your many goals were disallowed because of the offside, and because of that, the game is more interesting. Because if you think of a game that doesn't have an offside rule, like, for example, basketball, right? You can score, 80 points. If you had an offside rule that was a bit more tricky than the one we have, it would be difficult to even score goals. So the offside rule as it is now, I will argue, makes it possible for football to be exciting and intense and to create and evoke a sense of beauty in us. So the first offside rule stipulated that anyone that was in front of the ball was offside. Meaning, if I had the ball and my friend was in front of the ball and I just passed the ball to him, that was considered offside. I don't know if this reminds you of rugby, but this is why in rugby you cannot really pass to the front, you can only pass to the side. And so because of this offside rule, you cannot really pass the ball to your friend who's in front of you. You cannot create any interesting play, no? You can only pass to the side or backwards. So the result of this was that people, the strikers or the players in general, did not pass the ball when they were right next to the goal. You had to wait until you were in front of the goal to pass back, etc. This is why it was more of a dribbling game, like when we were kids and you don't really care about passing, and all you do is you just run with the ball, you want to score the goal yourself. For a reason here, because they couldn't really pass it, you would be offside. And this affects the formations. No, so this is why you have a lot of forwards, because you need people to score the goal. If you really think about it, this makes the game not fun at all. It's like for rugby, it works. Maybe, I don't know. But then I personally don't watch rugby. I don't even know whether you can call it beautiful. So for those who support rugby or watch rugby, I leave that to you to decide maybe after the talk. In 1866, they changed it. They changed the offside rule, and it became a player was onside when there were three players between him and the goal. So you had the goalkeeper. Let me show you here. So you had the goalkeeper, and then two other defenders or two other players of the opponent. And this also makes it difficult. Players were easily making the offside trap. It's imagine three players that have to be between you and the goal, and that's it. It's very easy to be able to be successful at the offside trap, right? The opponent team would easily keep you or put a player offside, and then you cannot score goals. And it created a problem in England as well, because you can simply just defend, and the offside trap would disallow or would make it more difficult for the teams to score goals. In this case, you would also be more interested in dribbling and just attacking without probably any interesting strategies. It becomes more difficult to really create space, to create the goal, to create a chance to shoot at the goal. And then in 1925, they decided to reduce the number to two. So now for one to be onside, there has to be two players, the goalkeeper and another player, a defender or whoever it is, right? Because if there's only the goalkeeper, if you're behind the, or if you are between the defenders and the goalkeeper, it becomes considered offside. So now it's easier. You should only beat one defender, not two. Because of that, the game became more complex. Now the entirety of or the entire team now is working in a way such that they are trying to beat or to try to create chances such that they are not offside. And this is why, so along with the implementation of the 1925 offside law, arises an important problem to tackle: how to generate space in order to score more goals. Players were increasingly becoming more specialized, evoking a sense of specialization, right? Because usually players were here, like a defender was becoming more of a defender, a central midfielder was a midfielder, and a forward was just playing that. And it became more like a machine. Think in terms of English games, like if you just do what you have to do, and then you pass the ball, and then you score a goal, and like machines, they were playing. But that wasn't enough. Arsenal's Chapman, for example, they had this WM formation. They would attack, and then they would defend, and they were doing it efficiently. Everyone was specialized. If you're a defender, you cannot play as a midfielder or a forward, etc. You just do what you have to do. And you just have to do your job, right? Do this like a machine and you would be good. And then they had zonal marking, which made scoring goals more difficult, right? If you park the bus and you do absolutely nothing, how can you create space? How can you get through the defenders to score a goal? You either shoot from the outside or you make a cross ball or something along the lines. You try to get a free kick or from corner kicks, etc. This is why people like Victor Maslow and Rinus Michels started thinking about what we now know as total football. And total football was trying to make things more dynamic, more flowing on the football field. So instead of having each player in one position doing what they do best, now players needed to be versatile. They needed to be able to cover up for their peers. They needed to be able to exchange positions, to play a dynamic game. So if you're a right back or a left back, you can fill in, you can become as a fullback, you can go up to score a goal, and then you constantly, or players were constantly on the move in a way. So under total football, a different conceptual understanding of football emerges. Now it is not as important to excel at one position only, but what is crucial is that the team the team members organically interact with each other such that each player fills the gap in order to maintain a certain stability while at the same time moving the ball around in order to generate enough space to break through the opponent's defenders. So think in terms of Barcelona, for those who have been watching football lately, the Barcelona of Guardiola with tiki-taka passes, right? It's part of total football. This was started with Rinus Michels, as I said, and then Cruyff picked it up, and Guardiola learned it from Cruyff. Players are constantly on the move, forming triangles, passing the ball, because it doesn't matter whether you're a defender or you're a forward, etc. You have to be able to do or to fill all these positions. So much so that, for example, for Barcelona, it's essential that the goalkeeper is able to be, is capable of passing the ball, to play with his, to use his foot, right? Not just kick it. He needs to be able to dribble. He needs to be able to pass the ball here and there, to be able to even look at spaces and interpret spaces, to be able to know whom to pass it to, when and how. Because if you've been following Barcelona over the past 15 or 10 to 15 years, when the goalkeeper fucks up, they would more often than not concede goals. So the entire point of this total football is to constantly try to look for spaces. And how do you look for spaces? Well, by being constantly on the move, trying to distract the team on the one hand, and trying to widen up the field when you're attacking, and to narrow it down when you're defending. So you want to leave them less space as possible when the opponent is attacking, and you want to have as much space as possible when you are attacking. So here we find ourselves, metaphorically speaking, before a space-time continuum, such that the attacking team has to be weaving space-time coordinates in order to create an empty spot and to create a chance on goal. Right? It's not easy anymore to score goals strategies and tactics and formations become ever more complicated given the offside rule. It's like You can get lucky once by scoring from outside the area. You can get lucky twice if you have someone like Messi who can score free kicks. You can have you can be lucky, or you can train corner kicks, etc., and have tall players to score goals. But then ultimately, if you're not good with the ball, if you cannot create spaces, if you cannot dribble and pass the ball around, and if you cannot manipulate the coordinates on the pitch, you won't ever be able to create a chance on goal. You can rely on counter attacks, for example, but then it doesn't always work. And you would have really a hard time to score a goal. So on the matrix of the pitch, in a way, what teams, if you look at them, have been constantly learning, even English teams now. This is why they got Klopp and they got Guardiola and they got all these coaches who brought in different concepts. Before, English teams and were more of a utilitarian. You run, you're fit, you score a goal. It still kind of is, but then things have been changing over the past five or six years. Arsene Wenger, for example, played like that with Arsenal, but then Arsenal always come in fourth, so they needed something also more, but you get the point here. So it's things become ever more complex on the pitch. And this is why, for example, Cruyff, with Total Football, as Barry, excuse my pronunciation, Hulshoff is going to be writing here or saying, we discussed space all the time. Cruyff always talked about where people should run, where they should stand, when they should not be moving. It was all about making space, coming into space. It is a kind of architecture on the field. So players on the field are really aware of all this, because you need to be able to fill the spaces so that you wouldn't create or make, so that you on the one hand can create for yourself an opportunity, and on the other hand, so that when you're attacking, you don't leave a space open for the opponents to score a goal either. And this is not an easy task. So much so that, for example, Müller is considered to be a Raumdeuter, if I pronounce it correctly, an interpreter of space. And this article even says the first and possibly the last interpreter of space, in a way. Why is someone like, so nowadays, one of the skills for you to be able to be a decent or a good player or a skilled player, in addition to dribbling and, you know, being fit, etc., is to be able to read space on the pitch. And all this, why? Because it's the game is forced to do that given the offside rule. So someone like Xavi, for example, or someone like Xavi Alonso, the other Xavi, and these midfielders and Busquets, they are very important. So much so that when they are off or not feeling so well on one of the games, it's like really the Barcelona don't do well. So why all this? It's because they are able, and Zidane, of course, so that those who are Madrid fans. This is because really what the players are constantly doing, they're trying to see how, where, and when, and they're constantly looking around them, and they're constantly looking for places, and where would I pass now? How would I create a chance? How would I, like Ronaldinho, for example, would look to one side and then pass it to the other, etc. How can I fool the opponent to think that I'm going this way, then go the other way, right? And it's not easy. So Cruyff and these people say, Cruyff, it looks so simple, but it's very difficult to do. So it is as though there's a leap between building the play and the actual singularity, whereby a player is able to break through and to score. Because if you are a football fan, how many times have you lamented the fact that they they did not, or the goal was annulled because it was an offside, right? Over, even now with VAR, it's over a split second kind of. And it sucks because there's something about this goal in particular that makes it even more beautiful. The play, the buildup for the play, and then the moment that the player is able to break through the opponents or to just to break the trap and be able to score a goal. So the entire goal, for players and for teams to be able to do that, they need to really have a solid midfield and a certain level of complexity that the versatile players can fill the gaps at any time. This ability to control the tempo and the rhythm is really not easy to find. So this is why they call Xavi, the Barcelona Xavi, a maestro, right? The analogy is as though he's really a maestro and controlling the tempo and the rhythm of the game as though it's an orchestra. And they did describe Barcelona as such at one point. Now Barcelona sucks, for those who are following Barcelona. So all this creates the chance of what I call, I'm using this novum, which is a philosophical concept by Ernst Bloch, I'm using on football. It's like this radically new is the result of an unpredictable event, an unpredictable decision by the players to either dribble their way to the goal, like for example, Maradona's goal, or to be able to create a chance through the different passes, right? The buildup to the goal. So in these split seconds, my claim is this is where beauty comes in. Why? Because football is really just like it has a clear set of rules, right? Offside the different fouls and penalties, etc. It's all well defined. And it happens on a pitch that is 90 meters and 130 meters, more or less. This is the maximum, right? So the pitch is pretty well defined and well determined, and the rules are well determined. Why do we keep coming to football? No, it's, and you know that they're going to be passing the ball across, and they're going to be defending, and they're going to be attacking. So it's, if you really think about it, there's nothing special about football, no? But my argument here is that, so beauty, where does beauty come in? Well, beauty comes in when there is this break, this singularity on the pitch, when they really create this space that allows people to, or that allows the attacker or the player to score a goal. Because otherwise, football is redundant. It's the same concept. Passes around, you go back, you come forward, you throw the ball, you cross the ball, you try to score a goal, etc. It's more or less monotonous up to a certain point. But then we keep coming to football knowing that it's just about, you know, scoring goals and all that jazz. The special thing about football is that we keep coming because of these moments, which are incidentally not rare. Why? Because of the way football is, because of how the rules are made, particularly the offside rule. Because add one player, you're fucked. Just eliminate the offside rule all along, it becomes just, you know, whatever. So this radically new kind of, it's metaphorically speaking, the emergence of a space in a kind of radically new way on the pitch is what makes us have this feeling of sublime and beauty in a way, particularly beauty. You look at the game and you're like, oh, fuck, this is a really beautiful play, or this is a really beautiful goal. Why? Because even if it was a double kick, let's say, or even if it's just a normal pass, The key is in how the pass was made, how the space was created, how the player decided to boot the ball or to shoot it at the goal or the angle, etc. It's things that you really are not expecting them at the moment. Because there are other goals where they score and you're like, oh yeah, fine, this is a goal. But then it's not as beautiful as other goals that create something which is unexpected, unpredictable, radically new in a way. So this experience of the radically new, of the novum, is what I think the condition of possibility for the occasion of the aesthetic experience. Without this new set of whatever it is, the emergence of space, how the players create a chance on goal, I think it would not be as beautiful as, or as, between brackets, orgasmic as other plays, right? Because if someone scores from a goal kick, from a corner kick, well, you know what. But how they scored from a corner kick, this is where it becomes interesting, because also in these kind of sets, there's an interpretation of space, which Müller, for example, is very good at. It's like he's always at the right place at the right time to just either head the ball or kick it or do something about it. And therefore, what I argue here is that the novum or the beauty is when all these redundancies in football and all these cliches of passes and passing the ball around is broken. When this is broken, it really is, or it really evokes a sense of beauty in us, philosophically speaking. So, as I said here, I would defend the thesis that this aesthetic experience is closer to the category of the beautiful insofar as one is contemplating a clever play that transcends and breaks redundancies. And unpredictable plays as broken redundancies, which I already went over. And this is the last kind of slide here. So why did I speak about the sublime and the beauty and the players and spectators and people who are involved and engaged, etc.? Well, the reason why football, I argue, in addition to all that, is really more interesting in that sense, because think about it this way. We are trying to watch a game that is a beautiful game. So let's say you're watching Barcelona versus Real Madrid, or Liverpool Barcelona, or Manchester City Liverpool, whatever you want. And you are a Barcelona fan, and then Madrid, back in the day, Ronaldo, or now Vinicius, or whoever it is, scores a very beautiful goal, right? So me as a Barcelona fan, how should I react, right? And I don't know whether you've seen this experiences before, but Ronaldinho, for example, at one point in his career, when he was playing against Real Madrid with Barcelona, he really got a standing ovation from in the Santiago Bernabeu, from Real Madrid fans, right? So in this case, what happens there? Why did Madrid fans give Ronaldinho a standing ovation? Well, this is the tricky part about the game, because we all want to watch a beautiful game. We all want to watch a beautiful spectacle. But then when I am on the other side, the side that is conceding goals, if the goal is really beautiful, so if I am England, or I am Madrid, or I am Barcelona, and I'm like the Liverpool 4-0 win, I have mixed feelings, because on the one hand, I feel pain, but on the other hand, I am in awe of what or of the plays and the determination that Liverpool players have to score such goals and to make a comeback and to make it through, right, to the next round. So this is where I why I included the sublime, because I think the beauty of the game lies in the fact that it creates all these tensions, including the offside rule, including the rules, including the spectacle, and including the involvement of the spectators, fans, and rivals, such that everyone is having some sort of sensation. So as spectators, you're either having a beautiful experience because your team scored, or you are having a sublime kind of feeling because on the one hand, you really think that this is a beautiful goal, but at the same time, it's fucking, you're fucking losing. So all these kind of complexities that emerge, including the history and like how many times Madrid won versus how many times Barcelona won, and the space on the pitch and the players trying to create new spaces to score because it's becoming ever difficult with now technology, etc. All this creates an interesting context for the aesthetic experience to emerge and to arise, such that when really this radically new happened, when like who would have thought that a team would make, or that Liverpool would make a comeback against Barcelona? Well, precisely because it's something new, it's something unpredictable at the time. This is where all the emotions are in a way released. And this is why I think, or this is what makes football in a way complex enough for us to be able to have an aesthetic experience that would allow us to either have an aesthetic experience of the sublime or of the great player, not as quick. This is just, I'll end with this note.
Ronaldinho again, he's already done Ramos once, here he goes, Ronaldinho! Ronaldinho, 3-0! Ronaldinho! My word! Why is he the golden boot we have seen? My goodness me.
And I tell you, Paul, if people stood up and applauded Ronaldinho last time, would say probably 50, maybe not 50, a big chunk of this stadium is on their feet applauding him.
Yeah.
What a magnificent player this guy is. As you say, he's won the France Football Ballon d'Or, European Football.
As a conclusion, I ended on this note with Ronaldinho, that in these cases, when you're able to recognize the beauty, even if you're having this a sublime feeling, this is what makes the game ever more interesting and exciting, in a way. Thank you. So